We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. Which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Three, two, one, zero. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Welcome back to the UFO show, Dan.
Thank you. Wow. Whoa. Look at that spooky Thai voice. I like. How are you?
It's got a little grovel to it. A little more raspiness than usual. It's ever since that McConaughey interview, man. That's what did me in.
Really?
Yeah, I don't. About midway through.
You just gave so much juice?
About midway through. If you go back and listen, I don't know how intently folks listen to our show, but about midway in, my voice just starts cutting out. I'm starting to worry that maybe McConaughey took my voice. Maybe it's gone for good.
Wow. You know what? Maybe it'll come back in an interesting way. Maybe it goes all the way down and you reboot it from square one and you have like a cool accent.
Right, a Portuguese accent. It comes back Portuguese, exactly.
Yeah, I would love that. I would love for that. That's a real differentiator in the space. Ty, it's the UFO show, is it not?
It is the UFO show. And as you know, so we had a big interview a week ago. Mm-hmm. We're continuing with that trend, that ultra mega star Friday trend, Dan, with another superstar in our world, are we not?
We are absolutely welcoming back to the show Bruce Feldman to talk about his new book, brand new book, Flip the Script, Lessons Learned on the Road to a Championship.
Yeah.
I always get it. On the Road to a Championship, about not just the 2019 LSU undefeated, wildly successful and explosive offensive season, but also the specific path that Ed Orgeron took from, you know, longtime assistant to interim coach at USC into essentially being unemployed. And I asked Bruce I did the interview myself. That's the spoiler right now. But what Ed Orgeron was up to in that year gap, he took a gap year between when he was hired by Les Miles as a defensive line coach and everything that happened at USC and what that added to his path and then how everything came together for 2019, Joe Burrow stuff, Joe Brady stuff, Dave Aranda stuff, and even touched on how we look back on it now knowing that the postscript, flip the script, postscript, you see what I, come on, Dan, come on, Ty.
You're a true pro.
Rubbing my back. How that characterizes it, if at all, because of the weird defensive downfall and offensive struggles and injuries and new assistants. So fascinating stuff with Bruce. He gave me and us a ton of time. And we also talk Pac-12 with the season out west beginning, I guess you're listening to this Friday or Saturday, but imminently.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get to some news on that front. Maybe not all Pac-12 teams will be in action this weekend, given circumstances, but alas, some probably will, and it is exciting to now have the full boat back. In general, as you said, since you did the interview, trying to give my voice a little bit of a bye week here,
yeah.
What was Bruce's general takeaway with regard to the Pac-12 this season? Is it playoff worthy? Are there any teams that he is super bullish about? I guess we'll get into that. We'll get to hear all of that. But what was your initial takeaway from, I guess, Bruce's takeaway of the conference?
I think he has a lot of optimism. And I use the term room for growth because it's obvious when you look across the conference where the specific room for growth lies with new coaches in, I think there's only two new coaches this year. Maybe I got that wrong, but Carl Durrell and Jimmy Lake. Am I missing anybody? I think that's across the board. Those are the new coaches. But a lot of new coordinators, big time coordinator hires, and a lot of big questions. We didn't really talk about playoff stuff because, I don't know, at this point in the Pac-12 season, that doesn't seem fully relevant and where the Pac-12 has been these past couple of years. I just want to see good football and improve football in the Pac-12. And I think Bruce is aligned with that. And so he weighed in on his thoughts on Oregon losing what they did, but what the guys they have back can possibly do, along with Joe Moorhead and Jimmy Lake at Washington and the experience of Keaton Slovis at USC with that new Todd Orlando defense on the other side, and possible optimism with the Arizona schools and UCLA. And so we get on to a lot of the Pac-12 mountaintop just in terms of a 10,000-foot view of the conference. So he's out west. He knows all these guys. He's going to, he's at their practices in normal times. So he has a relationship with a lot of the people in the conference. So really cool to have Bruce weigh in. And obviously, as you know, aside from the book Flip the Script, you can listen to Bruce with Stu Mandel on the Audible and read him at The Athletic.
All right, before we get to your interview with Bruce, we do have some news, Dan, since I can't do the breaking news thing, here's the sound. Do you have a spin on my normal kind of antics that you would like to add in here?
Breaking news!
Not bad.
My rich, healthy voice.
You don't have the falsetto, but it's okay.
I wouldn't try. Breaking news!
Yeah, okay.
There are some unfortunate COVID cases around college football. So if you're wondering why your perceived slate has been disrupted for Saturday and beyond, it looks like Virginia has been postponed, I think only a week, to November 14th, if my calendar math is correct. Cal Washington looks to be somewhat in doubt at the time we're recording this because of a positive test within the Cal program. I think it's Tulsa Navy is off. I don't want to get that wrong and say Tulane Navy. I know it's a TUL, but I'm verifying now it is Tulsa Navy that has been, it says, postponed with no makeup date announced at the moment. So there's that. Joe Rossi, the Minnesota defensive coordinator, has contracted COVID. I haven't seen anything regarding symptoms. I hope he is all right. And to sort of bring it all full circle, so obviously Rossi will be missing Minnesota's game against, I believe, Illinois. And to bring things sort of full circle, just with a show Bruce Feldman is involved with, I don't know about his specific health, but because of COVID protocol, big noon Saturday. So it's Urban Meyer, Rob Stone, your boy Brady Quinn, Reggie Bush, Matt Leinart are all quarantining because of Fox Sports COVID protocol. And so there will be no big noon Saturday this weekend hosted by the normal people, if that's a show you watch. I think they're bringing on like Emmanuel Acho and stuff like that, who's great. But I think it's a bunch of NFL people, I want to say, just standing in. We were available, no longer because we're insulted, but we were available.
Yeah, we were. No, it's true. My voice isn't. It's still not back. But
I mean, we can get Pete, right? We can get Mayor Pete. His TV experience. We can get Pete Buttigieg to talk about...
To do a Ty Hildenbrand impression.
I think that's the move. If why settle?
That's
for
what
some
people told me in Washington.
Boardwalk impressionist
in D.C. That's what folks said.
Yeah. I think that covers a lot of the news. Maction is back, which is pretty exciting. So we'll talk about a little bit more about the Mac returning on our recap show. But I think that's the news I have. And stay tuned. Post Bruce, another tease, because we'll get into the interview now, Ty will give his gut intrigue instinct thoughts about what he just wants to watch this season, these six regular season games in the Pac-12 for everybody. And also, we're going to tie this UFO show to the, I guess, guest as well on this undefeated Feldman orbit.
Wow.
Thank you.
Undefeated. Feldman Orbit. We are excited to hear from Bruce. It's always a pleasure to have him on the show. Don't forget, if you're out and about this weekend, if you're looking to stay in tune with college football, find out what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
College Football Blitz, put on by our good friends at Learfield IMG College. You can get to it by searching for College Sports Now on TuneIn or by going to Channel 84 on your Sirius XM dial. They jump in and out of local broadcasts. It's really cool. I said this time and again, it's been my secret weapon over all these years. I'm glad that we finally get to promo it because they do an awesome job jumping in and out of broadcasts. You get something like 56 minutes, I want to say, of actual play-by-play coverage every hour. It goes all day long, all throughout the College Football Saturday. So if, like me, you're going to be out there in the world, you can't always be perched in front of the TV. Maybe you're making your own window of opportunity. I don't know. Whatever the case may be for you, College Football Blitz is where it's at. They can help you stay up to date, of course, until you get to Sunday or Monday and get a chance to listen to the Solid Verbal.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
All right. And with that, it's been far too long. Obviously, it's very difficult during a season. We had him on to talk about, I think, Miami, Ohio State when we were doing the rewatches. But he is the author of the brand new book, Flip the Script, about Ed Orgeron and the 2019 LSU Championship Tigers. You read Meat Market. You read The QB. You've seen him on sidelines. You've listened to him on The Audible. You read him on The Athletic. I don't know, Big Noon Saturday. I mean, honestly, we could turn this show into your resume, but Bruce Feldman, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Dan. It's good to hear your voice. You know how much I respect you guys and what you do, and it's very cool to reunite with you.
Nice. All right. So you write this book. I want to talk about this. I have not read the book yet. I've read reviews. I've listened to you talk about it. I watched a lot of 2019 LSU football. But what does Flip the Script and Lessons on the Way to a Championship Season? I think I'm paraphrasing that. But where does Flip the Script come from?
So here's where it comes from. So as you mentioned Meat Market at some point, I really wanted to tell the story of how college football programs recruit. And so I was on the fly on the wall for 2 years there. And basically the book did pretty well. And I think a lot of people would ask me, hey, are you ever going to do a sequel to this? And I really didn't think I would. But I did follow Orgeron's career from after a spectacular flameout at Ole Miss. And then he gets on, and you know the story, eventually gets to be the interim head coach after Lane gets fired at USC. And then,
right.
Things really turn up for him and go in a different direction. And I think the Flip the Script term really came from basically in Dan and Bruce parlance, he basically pulled the Costanza. And he did everything the opposite of all his instincts at USC, and it worked. Now, I don't think it was as simplistic as that, but because he had been through the process of his battles with substance, and he's now 20 years sober, but his issues with alcoholism, I think he's learned from the recovery process and taken those lessons and that really deep look inside of like, hey, you know, I may not have had a great relationship with my AD at Ole Miss, and I may not have the resources and this and that, but ultimately it's, I got to look inward with me first. I can't make all these excuses and on other people and blame other people. I got to start with me. So I think he learned from his own mistakes. Then when he got to USC, and certainly when he was at Tennessee, he was Lane's right-hand man there. Mm-hmm. And then he was certainly Lane's right-hand man at USC. So when Lane gets fired, he sees all this stuff that Lane has been doing and how he's running the program. And he was like, we're going to flip the script and do all these things basically opposite to get guys respond. And it's crazy because, as you know what his persona is, I had asked him, I said, you know, you're kind of doing a George Costanza here. Do you know what that is? And he kind of knew who George Costanza was, but he's, you know, he's not a Seinfeld watcher, or wasn't.
Right.
So, but.
And the Seinfeld reference, to be clear, is George wakes up one day and decides everything he's been doing has been wrong, so he might as well do the exact opposite.
Yeah, at some point, I feel like they're in the diner, and there's like a attractive woman, and he's like, I'm going to order this, this, and this, and he goes, no, I'm not. And then he rethinks it and goes against everything else, and all of a sudden, his luck turns. And that, to some degree, is how things change for Ed Ogeron and USC, and then subsequently, I think he really kept on building on that. So that's where Flip the Script comes.
Okay. And so he obviously, after USC and before LSU, he's sort of in no man's land. He's not working. Les Miles eventually hires him to be a defensive line coach, and Ed Orgeron eventually goes on to be an interim and full-time coach at LSU. What was that period of time like when a major head coach at USC, interim head coach, and assistant coach at LSU, there's that space? What is that a time where Ed Orgeron's working on himself? Is that a time where he's working on what he's going to do if and when he gets another opportunity? What is that blank period like?
That's a great question. So it really was, and I don't know if he would have described it as I'm working on myself, but I think what he really realized is, remember, this is a guy who, when he was the head coach, when he was at Tennessee, he lived in a hotel, and he didn't want to take his kids out of school in Louisiana. And so, you know, he would commute back to see them sometimes. And then when he was at USC, the kids were already in high school. He did not want to move them. So he lived in the Radisson near USC. And that was for a few years. So when he gets told, and he doesn't find this out from Pat Hayden, the AD at USC, he finds it out from somebody else that Steve Sarkisian's actually getting the USC job, not him. He is crushed. And, you know, he said, other than when his dad died, it was the worst day of his life. And so he flies, you know, he goes back home with his wife, and he is, you know, he is devastated to the point where his kids had told me, and now his kids are both, out of college, but he had said that they had told me, we'd never seen our dad like unshaven and scruffy and lying and sleeping on the couch all day. Like, it was like, it wasn't just like a guy going through or a woman going through a bad breakup. It was like that times, you know, probably 20 for him. And, you know, I think the guy who's really been kind of a big brother to him, Brian Kennedy, who's really helped him out through the recovery process for these 20 years. You know, he had talked to me about, and Brian's sober now, so about 50 years, about just how much concern he had, because when people go through very traumatic experiences, you know, lose a job, wife leaves them, whatever, that can, I mean, for lack of a better term, you know, when people go off the wagon. And he was like, I called him, I couldn't hear anything back, and I worried. And Ogeron told me for the book that, you know, at one point, Urban Meyer had reached out to him about possibly a D-line job. Nick Saban had, and he was like, I would have been good to nobody at that point, the way I felt. And where the worked on himself part was, he really threw himself into getting back into his son's lives. His one son was like, I guess, the best tennis player in the state of Louisiana in his age range. And he started going out to all his tennis matches, and his son was telling me, and this is, Cody, who actually ended up being the starting quarterback at McNeese State, was like, you know, my dad's coming to these tennis matches. And, you know, he's got that voice. And I'm like, Dad, you don't do that at tennis matches. And, you know, and he goes, and nobody goes to tennis matches in Louisiana. So it's bad enough his voice carries, but now he's one of like three people there, and he's grumbling and rough, you know, and yelling things. And they're like, Dad, you got to chill. And then, you know, his other brother, his twin brother played football. And so he would be out at those, and same thing, you know, it's just like, I think he kind of got a deeper connection with his sons. And I think that really impacted him. Now, there's so many crazy twists in Ogeron's life, but I think this one really is something that you have to like take a step back to kind of get how improbable his story is. So he obviously gets like most guys who are football coaches, if you become an interim head coach, you maybe get one or two or three games tops. Usually guys don't get fired in September or with almost a full season. So Lane obviously got fired early in the season at USC. So Ogeron got 8 games to basically show that he was not the head coach that he looked like he was at Ole Miss. Well, then he goes to LSU. And remember, LSU, there was a game that they were playing in November against Texas A&M. And all the reports are that LSU is going to fire Les Miles. And the stadium is all packed in support of Les Miles, who's obviously a very, you know, beloved character who also is kind of larger than life, you know, Les's persona. And the players play their butts off for him, and they beat Texas A&M, and LSU doesn't end up firing him late in the year. But you know what? Like, so there's no coaching search at LSU. If there was a coaching search, they're not hiring Ed Ogeron at that stage to be the head coach at LSU. Instead, they keep Les on. He loses to Wisconsin in Lambeau to start the season. And later he loses to Auburn. They fire him early. So the chance of being an interim head coach twice is rare to begin with. The chance to be an interim head coach and have almost a full season is ridiculous. And then he gets it. You know, he's kind of made the additional tweaks from his time at, you know, when he was at USC even more so. And I think that really helped him get at least a real shot at getting this job, which is, again, so shockingly improbable given his path.
What is the biggest difference between, I remember there was a cookie story, right, at USC that he let guys eat cookies. And that it sounds funny, it sounds silly, but like you want guys to buy in. You want guys to trust you. You want guys to believe that you are on their side. What is the biggest difference? Is it a culture thing? Is it an on-field thing between whatever Ed Orgeron was doing, even at USC, but between what he did in a less successful part of his head coaching career and what he eventually was able to do at LSU?
You know, before I get to that, it's funny, the cookie thing stands out to a lot of people. And when we talked about it at USC, one of the things that he kept on bringing up was like, Lane will get that turkey bacon in there. And I was like, he talked about turkey bacon, like the way I think of like fat-free cheese that I once had. It was like, okay, you know, this is unconscionable or whatever, but his disdain for the turkey bacon they served at USC, you know, just like it seems to stick in his craw to this day. Well, anyway, to me, the biggest difference in him, and I didn't know this until we started working on the book really and talking about it, and then it started to materialize, was his understanding of like, I knew he had evolved. And, you know, look, I once worked on a book with Mike Leach. Mike Leach might be the most stubborn of the stubborn people in a profession that's, you know, loaded with stubborn dudes. And they don't usually evolve or they don't change much. So I knew Ogeron had evolved and it was clear that he had, but what I was kind of thinking in terms of this is you become different. And what he had kind of explained and articulated in a way where I don't even know, he was like not telling me that this is what happened. He was just telling me about it, was the instincts you have, they don't change. The impulses you have, they don't change. What changes, if you're fortunate or if you've, you know, done the work and get to know yourself and get to know who you are, and for better or worse, how that, and this is why I think the book is like, this is why I'd be selling the book in terms of like, why it's a lot more than a football book is, and this is, you know, relatable to anybody, not just Ed Ogeron or a football coach, is the awareness that he ended up having was like, okay, this is my instinct would have been to do this. Well, I did it that way at Ole Miss, or I did it that way before, and it didn't work so good. So I know I can't do it that way. And so I think what's so different for him is he knows himself, and he knows, because he said this to me at one point, and there's a story after they beat Alabama in Tuscaloosa, yes, last year. And he's like, the old me, or the one at, when I was at Ole Miss, I would have done it this way. And it would have been, and the example he, you know, we're talking about in the book specifically to this, was they beat Ole Miss, and I don't know, I mean, they beat Alabama. I don't know if you remember this, but there were, one of the players took out a cell phone in the post-game speech. And it was the, you know, I don't know if I can say it out loud or on your show, but like that gets out. Now, it's not the most inflammatory thing, but it's definitely not something that LSU is going to put on their Twitter feed. And so he apologized for it. But then he said, you know, the player who did it, basically came to me and was very apologetic. And he was like, the old me would have, you know, turned that into like a 2-day story, and I would have gone off on it or whatever. And he's like, you know, I knew he made a mistake. It wasn't like a guy who got in front of a car, you know, under the influence and had a horrific accident and, you know, like whatnot. It was like, it's an error in judgment. And it's like, okay, this is like one of my sons. How would I handle it? I was like, you know, you screwed up. Hey, don't do that again. I love you still. Just let's, you know, make better decisions. And the team ends up noticing how somebody gets treated, you know, like it's treated in that where they already feel bad enough that, you know, they mm-hmm. don't want, and then all of a sudden you run a truck over them, you know, emotionally, and then it just makes it worse. And so I think that was a really interesting window where when he told me the story, it didn't all sink in all the way. And then it did the more we talked about it.
So something that's obviously been talked about a ton and credited to Ed Ogeron a ton was his hiring of Joe Brady before the 2019 season, as he realized, and I know you've written about this, that they wanted to go to the spread. He just sort of told Steve Ensminger, the existing offensive coordinator, we're going to the spread, make preparation, stuff like that. He made that decision. But Joe Brady specifically does not fit necessarily with the types of coordinator hires that Ed Orgeron made before, like you've mentioned, at Ole Miss. I think he hired himself as defensive coordinator at Ole Miss.
Mm-hmm.
And even since, you know, instead of going with a sort of an up-and-comer and paying them and somebody who has been identified and recommended like Joe Brady was, even since hiring Bo Pelini, for example, this year. I don't know if that's with his instinct or against his instinct, whatever. But Joe Brady definitely stands out. Was any of that expected? Any of the all-timiness of Joe Brady and that hire expected? And did he have to be pulled into and convinced of Joe Brady?
No. And in fact, Joe Brady is in part why Flip the Script exists as a book now. Because as I'd said, I would always get asked about, are you going to do the sequel or a sequel? And so Ogeron had told me about Joe Brady, you know, I don't know, maybe a year before he hired him, or at least, you know, a long time before he hired him, because he remembered, and I didn't know who Joe Brady was. I thought Joe Brady was older. I mean, I didn't think he was like 45. I thought he was like 37.
Right.
And then he explained more, and then I was like, oh, he's a Moorhead guy, and I know Joe Moorhead. And so, but then when he hired him, and he interviewed, like, he basically offered Brady the job. And then, like, Brady didn't accept the job right away. Like, I guess Joe Brady is the mind where I'm not going to, you know, I don't know if it's his dad or somebody had said, hey, don't make a decision instantly or whatever on anything. And so Joe eventually, you know, tells me I definitely want the job. And I don't know how long it was, but I remember I said, how is it going? He goes, you got to see this guy. He said, he just raved about what Joe Brady was bringing. He kept on saying he's got answers. He's got answers for everything. And I said, all right, well, you know, I'd like to come down there. And I thought I was going to do a story about it for The Athletic. Well, I eventually did do that. But so I went down in April of 2019, and I sat in a bunch of the meetings, and I had good access, and I went to spring practice. And then, You know, I met with Brady for a long time. And it's crazy because, you know, like that was the first time I think Joe Brady had ever done an interview. Like, remember, like most of these coaches, with the exception of like Leach and Charlie Weiss, like at some point they were a really good high school football player. So, you know, maybe in their town they got, you know, they would get some coverage or whatever. I mean, Joe Brady played, you know, was a receiver in a really good area of football in Dade County. And then he was a backup receiver at William & Mary. And then he was a GA at Penn State. And then he was basically a quality control guy at the Saints. So it's not like he's getting interviewed or anything. So it's like, he's pretty under the radar, but Ed was so convinced, like he loved what the Saints do. And he just got such a good vibe on him that he was like, this is going to be the perfect compliment to what I think. Like, he likes that Steve Ensminger is willing to be aggressive and throw the ball downfield. But in the RPO game, which Brady obviously had been versed in from his time with Moorhead at Penn State, but also a lot of the attacking stuff that the Saints do, especially what he was going to bring for the third down and in the red zone, he was like, this is going to be gold. Now, it helped that he had a lot of this played into how Joe Burrow is wired anyway. Right. Joe Burrow, I don't want you guys max protecting is not protecting me. It's causing me more problems. Right. I get everybody out and I will attack it, you know, and give me options. I don't need this all getting muddled in the middle of it. And I'm like relying on two guys to try to make magic. And that stuff took off. And so what was, you know, fun for me with the book was when you talk to Joe Brady, or I got some great stuff from Joe Burrow and from other guys on the staff about how this thing evolved and how quickly it evolved and how it took off like wildfire. Was that to me is like the inside stuff. Like if I'm a football coach or if I'm an SEC fan, I want to dig into, but he was convinced. And so like, did I think they were going to win a national title after I came back from Baton Rouge on that trip in the spring? I didn't think that, but I thought they had a chance to be a real, you know, playoff team. And to the point where like The Athletic does these state of the program stories, and I'm writing about how, yeah, I know you feel like you've heard this before, whether it's Cam Cameron and Les Miles, and they're going to change, they're going to do something different. Oh, here comes Brandon Harris. He's more talented than the other quarterbacks LSU's had. Oh, wait, Ogeron just hired Matt Canada. He was the hot coordinator at Pitt. And it never worked out for LSU. It just underwhelmed and disappointed. But I know you heard that. This guy, Joe Brady, who, by the way, you've never heard of now, it's going to be way different, especially because, you know, with the exception of really the UCF Fiesta Bowl game, it wasn't like Joe Burrow was lighting up teams. He was playing well. But it wasn't like nobody saw that coming. And so when I came back, I was like, oh, boy, that's when I started working on the book proposal for Flip the Script after that trip, because I was so convinced and because Ogeron had, you know, been so high on what he had seen. He was like, this never happens where the offense just torches the defense in spring football, not here. And it was happening. And so that was where the ground started to move.
What was the interplay of egos like between, so you have Ed Orgeron and Steve Ensminger, who have combined to coach, you know, for 100 years or whatever, and you have Joe Brady, who's 30, has never been thrust in a position like this. And obviously, in order to really move an offense forward, in order to generate big points and big plays, whoever is calling the offense has to feel empowered, has to feel like they are in control and they don't have somebody looking over their shoulder constantly saying, this is how I think we should be doing things. And obviously, there had to have been a very successful interplay during the season between Ed Orgeron and his expectations, Steve Ensminger and what he had already done and what he is in control of, and Joe Brady and what he is bringing to the offense. It doesn't seem like it's obvious that a situation like that would just click. Why did it?
I think some of it clicked because Steve Ensminger knew that, all right, you know, I was the tight end coach for a while. I've been there, done that. And, you know, I want to be part of something really big. And this guy is going to help make that happen. I think when it came to Ogeron's part about bringing this other guy in, he knew this guy is our Sean McVay. Like, he had a lot of respect for Lane's mind as an offensive mind, as a play caller. And I think their personalities are way different, Joe Brady and Lane. But I think he, you know, there was something he was really sold on with, again, you know, in-game adjustments. Joe Brady's going to attack it. Like, he had a great admiration. I was going to say even respect, but it was like a great admiration for how Joe Brady thinks in the middle of things. So, you know, I think if you would ask him and say, who's the best recruiter on the staff or who's the best evaluator of talent, he's not budging on that. If you had asked him, like, who knows the most about D-line play, you know, even though he works with Bill Johnson, who was a mentor to him, I think that would be more of a begrudging whatever. But if it came down to, like, you know, who is the, like, do I know more than Joe Brady, even though he's almost half my age, he's not fighting that battle. He's embracing it all the way, to the point where when Joe Burrow came on his visit from, you know, came from Ohio State, and they had a bunch of their coaches in this Saturday meeting where they're watching all these cut-ups of Joe Burrow's stuff, in addition to some LSU stuff that they thought catered to him. Ogeron said to me, he goes, it did not take very long for me to realize who the smartest guy in the room was. And think about that. Like, Ogeron is, you know, very accomplished as a position coach, certainly, but he's been in the NFL. He's been at USC. He's learned under Jimmy Johnson. He's learned under Pete Carroll. He's learned under Paul Pasqualoni. Like, he's learned under some of the best in football. You know, you have Steve Enmeyer, who's been an SEC coordinator at a bunch of places. You have a lot of other guys who've been coordinators. And he's saying, you know what, this other guy who really has never played college football at any real length of time at this point because he couldn't get on the field at Ohio State, so this guy is the smartest guy in terms of football in the room. That's quite an admission. But when you see, and again, I'm the biggest believer in Joe Burrow as a player after what I've heard, what I've seen, you know, in meetings, at practice and walkthroughs, and they got it. Like, I don't know if Ogeron was the only one who felt that way at that point, you know, cause he's a defensive guy listening to somebody talk about how assertive he is, what he's seeing, how he's processing, you know, obviously. And Burrow's the son of a longtime defensive coordinator in the MAC, but it, you know, again, I think that speaks to, like, okay, I know what I don't know, and I want somebody who can bring me that. And he found guys who could bring him it.
When did belief develop in, you know, the coach's room, in the locker room, whatever, from, okay, we have a really fun offense, we're scoring points, this is unlike anything we've ever done. When did that belief translate into, I don't know if anybody can stop us? Is it, you know, that Texas game? Is it the weird Auburn game? Is it the Florida back and forth? Is it Alabama? When is that belief of, like, we're unstoppable? Where does that start?
I actually think it happened in the spring when there was a, and, you know, in the book, there's a really cool kind of passage where Burrow gets basically into two fights. One that starts where Jacoby Stevens, their safety, jumps up to try to block a pass and basically comes down on Burrow, and that starts a fight. And then Burrow felt like he wasn't in that enough, so he gets into a fight with Patrick Queen, like, right after, and it's a full-scale brawl. And then at that same practice, Ogeron said, like, he just torched our defense and, like, completed, like, 85% of his passes that day. And I came off the field going, we're going to be really, really good. He told one of the staffers that. I think then, because, you know, I heard that from multiple people in the program, not just Ogeron, that, and Joe certainly felt that way, and one of the offensive assistants felt that way. And I think they just realized, we know we have players on defense and we are just embarrassing them. And so, like, I knew that Ja'Marr Chase was a lot better than people realized, because I, you know, I'd been out at some practices in that spring, and I didn't know he was going to win the Biletnikoff, but I knew he was, like, All-American caliber. I knew Justin Jefferson was a big-time guy. I didn't see the Clyde thing coming for a while. I can't, you know, say that, but I think there was a lot of elements of that. So then when they got to Houston, when they got to Texas, I think it was like, hey, this is what we do now. You know, it's, we're not doing 4-minute offense because we're up and it's 3rd and 17. We're putting our foot on the gas, and this is a different day for LSU. And it built. I mean, for me personally, Like, I thought they were, after they beat Alabama, I was like, all right, I got a book. But I thought ultimately, I figured, all right, they're way better than Georgia. I mean, they kicked Georgia's butts the year before with, you know, without the same kind of team. And I just figured they would do it again.
Right.
I thought they would beat Oklahoma. I'd seen them. Oklahoma's a bad matchup. And I just remembered, you know, like before the playoffs started, I was like, eh, Clemson and Ohio State are just so talented on both sides of the ball. And it's Trevor Lawrence and it's Justin Fields. I think at some point the Cinderella story is going to not have a great ending. Well, after Oklahoma, I remember walking out of there because I had now seen a couple of games up close from the sideline and been with them, you know, for practices and meetings. And so, you know, after 5 years at Fox of being a sideline reporter, like I've seen a lot of teams right before games, you know, good teams, Ohio State, Oklahoma, you know, I've seen kind of and have the feel for it.
Right.
I've never seen a team as loose, focused, and confident right before kickoff as that LSU team is. I mean, I saw it against Georgia. I saw it against Oklahoma. And it's the exact same way they look at a Wednesday practice. And I was like, no matter what, I think Trevor Lawrence is terrific. I think Travis Etienne's terrific. Nobody's beaten this team, not this year, not the way they're playing. And, you know, so I, you know, kind of changed my thought on the fly after seeing it after a couple of times, because I at that point I was like, all right, I get it. You know, Clemson may score a bunch of points. They're not outscoring Joe Burrow, and they're not outscoring Clyde and Jamar Chase. It's just, they're just on a different level at this point. And that actually was kind of what happened. At one point they're down 17-7. Then all of a sudden Jamar Chase was like, F that, I'm going to take over. You can put your best defensive back on. He can play me well, and I'm still going to beat him. And it was like, that's what happened. And then all of a sudden, Trevor Lawrence, as talented as he is, could not keep up. And I just felt like their offense put so much pressure on teams that, and these were really good quarterbacks. I mean, Trevor is a great quarterback, right? And they just, they either get you in a hole or they just, you know, Ellinger played probably his best game of the season against them, and they still lost at home.
You mentioned as playing as loose or feeling as loose as they might in a Wednesday practice, and practice has become sort of lore in college football, right? You talk about Pete Carroll's loose practices, that Ed Orgeron was around, and maybe Nick Saban's practices where players say practice is harder than the games. You know, if you're able to perform in practice, games are nothing. Games are easy. And that is pretty apparent to anybody that watches a lot of Alabama football. What are Ed Orgeron practices like? Because obviously something worked from those practices after the spring when Joe Burrow looked that good. What were practices like last year, either from your own experience or from what you've heard?
You know, I think they're intense because he just radiates intensity. You hear that barking voice and everything. And so, you know, he wants to be precise in the details as it is in physical play. I think he had told me, like, he'd never seen teams practice any harder or with more energy and intensity than what Jimmy Johnson's teams had at USC, because those players were nasty. And it was like they were all about it. And you just didn't see anybody, you know, practice like that. USC had a lot of talent. I don't think it was quite to the degree of the nastiness and the edge that those Miami teams practiced with.
Right.
But then when he got this team at LSU, one thing that was interesting, he told me, which I didn't realize when I was there in the spring, but I noticed it later, was they, you know, most teams, when you go to their practice, they usually have, like, you know, music blaring, and he doesn't. And he was like, music is fake energy. I want our guys to have their own energy. If you don't clap, if you don't bring the energy, you guys are running. And so that was a big thing for him. And so there was, I mean, you know, his iron sharpens iron deal. Well, when, you know, I remember he showed this in one of like a morning film session that I was sitting in the room for. It was like, he must've rewound Jamar Chase against Derek Stingley Jr. like a half dozen times. And like, Burrow completes a pass, and I don't know how Stingley's right on top of him. And I don't know how Chase, you know, makes the catch sliding down to the ground. And it was just like, this is what makes us so good. You know, this is every day where these guys are being forced to challenge themselves. And so that's what those practices were like. And, you know, being at the practice where, you know, there's a lot of Joe, Joe Burrow is challenging everybody. He's challenging the defense in ways that those guys have never been challenged, both verbally, but also obviously, you know, on the field. It's just different. And the, you know, like that's, there's a lot of guys with ego and, you know, big personalities who are trying to measure up there. And I think that really helped them.
To what degree does either at Orgeron or people around the program, do they acknowledge that there had to have been some element of lightning in a bottle and sort of the universe, everything stars aligning between Joe Burrow, backup Ohio State quarterback, working out to become an all-time accurate, successful competitor. Ed Orgeron getting this job, which is, you know, he's local. It's, you know, a dream job of sorts, I'm sure, for him. The four receivers and that quality. Dave Aranda sticking around and signing the extension that he did to keep him at LSU. And having the LSU always has talent. But it felt like there were elements, especially the unknown of Joe Brady, you know, not really a big known commodity in coaching circles. Is it acknowledged that, yes, the stars aligned, but also we took advantage when we had that moment?
I think it is. I don't think, you know, even with the pandemic, I'm not sure how much anybody sat back. You know, that's something you and I would think, you know, like I think when they're in the moment, they don't think, hey, Clyde was a three-star, but look, Clyde's actually better than Leonard Fournette and Darius Geis, yep. You know, and he's because this offense fits him so well. I don't think anybody, you know, stopped and thought that way. I don't think anybody stopped and thought like, you know, Patrick Queen became a first round pick last year. Nobody saw that coming. Like I remember being there when they recruited Patrick Queen and got him on signing day and he thought he was talented and could really run. But like Patrick Queen wasn't the starter going into the year. Like we have a, you know, a scene in the book where Patrick Queen's parents want to speak to Orgeron and he's thinking, he probably wants to go in the portal. And basically, you know, Patrick, you know, his family says, what does he need to do to get better? And he was like, okay, these are the things I need to see from him. Well, Patrick Queen took that to heart and did those things. And then he was, you know, he was playing about as well as any linebacker in the country by the end of the year. Like he was a big reason why they were able to neutralize Travis Etienne in the national title game. So I think it's all that in that environment where that happened. But I don't think it's like ever been like, let me stop and think how improbable all these things are. Just because I think, you know, when you're in it, like they were, I just think if you stop and analyze it, it's counterproductive.
Sure, totally. Final question, and then we'll get into Pac-12 stuff because we have six games that each team is going to be playing, and we should talk about that. Has LSU start this year? We're now in week 10, and I don't know how many games LSU has played. You know, schedule's all over the place, but they've since hired essentially two new coordinators or a passing game coordinator and a new defensive coordinator, a new starting quarterback. They have opt-outs. The defense looks different. They obviously have a crazy week one. And the defense looks very different. The offense looks very different. Injuries to key dudes. Has LSU's 2020 characterized or made you reflect on 2019 any differently than you thought you would?
Not really. You know, like, look, they basically have almost the entire starting 22 moved on to the NFL. And the ones that didn't, you know, Jamar Chase opts out. Tyler Sheldon opts out, Kerry Vincent opts out, a few other guys opt out. So it's like, it's almost an entirely new cast. As you said, there's coaches who are not there. I mean, so basically the ones who are the holdovers is Terrace Marshall, who's a really good receiver, and Derek Stingley, who's a terrific cornerback, but he did miss the opener, like on, you know, he gets sick the night before the game. And then everything else is new pretty much. So it's a big rebuild that is happening in the middle of a pandemic. And I did not expect this. Like, I didn't think they were going to be a playoff team, but I still thought they had the talent to be a top 10 team. Like their defense has been a huge dud. Like I really would have thought they would have been a lot better than this, even without like Tyler Sheldon opting out. I still thought, okay, they're really good in the secondary. I know how talented some of those young guys are. They get Jabril Cox from North Dakota State. He's a really good player. I know they're high on Damone Clark and some of these other players in the front seven. And it just, Bo Pelini comes in and it's been a really bad fit. You know, Orgeron is more comfortable in the four-man front. And because that was Jimmy Johnson's system, that was certainly Pete Carroll's system. And Bo Pelini had learned under Pete Carroll. Well, like a lot of the, you know, it's been a lot of miscommunication. The players seem like they've had a lot of blown assignments. I don't know if they're just not understanding the checks to the defense or what, but it's been really bad. I mean, I don't think the offense has been, obviously when they played Auburn, you know, and the true freshman, they're playing a true freshman quarterback for the first time on the road, TJ Finley. He looked pretty good against South Carolina. He looked obviously overwhelmed against Auburn. I don't think it's, by and large, it's been really the offense has been like, I'm not sure what anybody expected given who was coming back. And especially if you know you're going to have to play a true freshman at some point. It's just been the defense has been so, so bad. I think it's like, hey, tread water, do the best you can in 2020 for the rest of the season. And then, look, we have a lot of really good young players. Hopefully we get this thing, you know, straightened out in 2021. And this year, I mean, it's not the same, but there are some parallels to his 2017 season where he hired Matt Cannon on offense. That was a bad fit. It didn't work out. They had a horrible loss, a blowout loss, Mississippi State. They lost to Troy. They barely beat Syracuse. I mean, they were really shaky. Now, what was different was they had better personnel on defense and they were more patched up on defense. So they could kind of carry that, at least be competitive and have a chance to win some of the games against some good teams. Right now, I don't think they have that. I mean, and so this is, like I said, this is a rebuild. I mean, you know, it's like, just how do you kind of, you know, kind of just tread water and plow forward. I mean, from my standpoint, it's just like putting out a book. This book was supposed to come out around SEC Media Days, but that then the pandemic hit and the publisher wasn't sure if we were going to have a season. And then they pushed it back to late October. And as much as we tried to get them to move it back up, they didn't. And so, you know, it's hard to put out a book when, even if you feel like you have a really, really good book, people are still going to see it as definitive, like on, hey, it's this, even though the book was ready in, you know, in late August, it's a 2-3 team, you know, and the LSU fans are kind of, I don't want to say they're over that they just want a national title, but now they're dealing with the right now, as opposed to still feeling the high of that, especially, like I said, it's in a pandemic. It's already a crazy enough year on top of that.
I can tell you this, if you're listening to this show, if you're listening to three solid verbals a week, you're going to be interested in a behind the scenes look at a championship team with championship coaches and championship players and what culture is like and what practice is like and what game is like. So even if you're an LSU fan who has moved on to being upset about this season, maybe pick up Flip the Script to remember the good times and stay warm as we head into winter, because I love Meat Market. I love the QB. Flip the Script, lessons learned on the road to a championship. Buy it. I don't know. Amazon, local bookstores, wherever you can find it. I'm positive it's great. So Bruce, I want to talk about the Pac-12 just because you're on the West Coast. I will not take nearly the time that we took talking about the book, because I'm sure there's just a ton to unpack with Flip the Script. But here's my first professional segue. There's a team in the Pac-12 that won their conference. They lost a top 10 pick at quarterback. They made a splashy coordinator hire. We don't know if it's going to work out better than Bo Pelini has worked out thus far. But the big question now is, did they lose too many dudes to both the draft and to opting out? That is the Oregon Ducks. Do you anticipate we are going to be saying they just lost too many dudes and the coordinator hire may not have fully worked out?
I like the coordinator hire. I think he's a really, really smart guy and he fits in with the staff. I think he will do well. You lose an entire offensive line right now. That is challenging. Yeah. You lose a big chunk of the secondary and you lose the best player, I think, on the defense in Javon Holland. We did a couple of their games last year and he was.
This is Oregon, by the way. Kind of,
yeah. I'm sorry. I thought that went without saying. Still think I have them to come out of the North, but again, like you said, I mean, new quarterback, I think the receiving core is going to be better because it felt like it was always a little underwhelming and the last couple of years, and mm-hmm. good running back. You know, Mario Cristobal is an O-line guy, and he's a good recruiter. I think they'll be pretty good still on the O-line, but I just think the margin for error, you know, Tyler Shuck, we'll see what he does. I've heard really good things about him in the last year plus. So mm-hmm. I see, when you look at what else is in the division, which you have Washington, new head coach, new offensive coordinator, and new quarterback. And I don't, you know, while I think they're really good in the secondary, but I think they have even more questions. And they don't have CJ Verdell to kind of lean on. Cal, the new offensive coordinator, I think Cal's actually going to surprise a lot of people. But to me, I think Oregon is a top 15 team. I'm not ready to say much more than that just because of what you said. They lost a lot of really good dudes.
I assume in the South, you feel pretty good about USC and their big offseason splashy coordinator hire was less splashy because Todd Orlando was going to be, I think, the defensive line coach for Texas Tech before USC made him their coordinator. USC does not have a tough schedule. I think, though, they should be favored in all of their games. Their toughest game looks like it's at Utah. If Todd Orlando is considered to be a good hire for the Trojans, where will it show on the defense this year that it just wasn't there for Clancy Pendergast and the Trojans last year?
Well, I think if they can keep Talanoa Hufanga healthy, he's terrific. He's just, you know, he's had a lot of wear and tear and, you know, shoulder yeah. injuries played through it, that kind of thing, but he's terrific. They got to get better on the corners. That's where they have not been like an elite program. I think if they can get some of their linebackers who, when you look at them, you're like, man, these guys should be really good. And then they miss a lot of tackles and they're out of position. And that part has been a disappointment. They're good up front. I like Todd Orlando. I think he's very aggressive. I think he's not easy to play against from talking to coaches who played against him. I think one of the challenges that they had at Texas was sometimes they were doing so much that some of those guys maybe got out of position. And, you know, when I've talked to people now who talk about Texas, they're like, well, the difference is maybe these guys, you're at Texas in the Big 12, you probably have better athletes, maybe not way better, but better athletes. You don't need to do a lot of crazy stuff. So I think, like, I like a lot of the hires that Clay Helton made and a lot of the moves he's made this offseason. I think they're the class of the division by far. I really am a big believer in Slovis. I think he's really talented. I love his temperament. The receivers are fantastic as a group. You know, you got Amon-Ra, you have Tyler Vaughns. Those guys are headliners. They are really excited about Drake London, who's a big receiver. Almost tight end size. They have a stable of running backs. The offensive line, now that they got Elijah Vera Tucker back after he opted out, to hop back in. And they have some, you know, like, as you said, the schedule. I mean, they get by Arizona State this weekend. I don't think Utah's going to be as good as they've been the last few years. They have so many guys to replace. Unless they stumble somewhere, I think they're going to, and they get Wazoo out of the North, who's in rebuild mode. I think they're well positioned to run through this regular season undefeated. I really do.
Let's sort of stay in the city, because UCLA and Arizona, I should add, both have head coaches who had sterling offensive reputations at previous college stops. Who is, between those two guys, Kevin Sumlin and Chip Kelly, who is closer to even approaching that level of at least just offensive success with their current teams?
I think UCLA is, because they have DTR, who's now got 3 years. This is the third year in the system. He's really talented. We've seen flashes from him. Dimitri Felton's a really good fit for what Chip Kelly likes to do. He's a, I don't know if scat back is the right way to call him, but like
right.
he's very shifty. He is a matchup nightmare to deal with coming out of the backfield. They have a pretty good group of receivers. I don't know what they're going to be like on defense, you know, in terms of, I don't know how much confidence you have in that group, because they've been really, really bad since he's been mm-hmm. there, or bad even before that. Whereas with Arizona, I know that staff likes Grant Gunnell. They are really excited about him. I just don't know. Maybe it's another year from now before that offense is clicking. Whereas I think Dorian Thompson-Robinson has breakout star potential there. I mean, he has a terrific arm. He runs well. He's in a system that I think he knows now. And he's got pretty good skill around him. You know, between Felton, you got Kyle Phillips, who's a really good slot receiver. You got some big targets. I don't think right now, and look, there's no reason for people to be, Chip Kelly's Oregon days notwithstanding, I don't think there's any reason for people to look at what UCLA has done in the first 2 years and say, oh, this is a team that has a chance to be anything close to a top 25 team, because there's nothing right. that's really shown that at this point, other than if you watch DTR a little bit, you're like, all right, you know, there's a chance there. And given the two things of what you said, one of the two, I'm more inclined to look at UCLA at the stage of development that program's in compared to what I think Arizona is, where they've had a bunch of opt-outs and kids transfer. Not that UCLA hasn't, but, you know, like, I feel like they've had like core nucleus guys leave because they didn't think they were going to have a season. And now like West Virginia's the most productive linebacker in the Big 12, who should be at Arizona, instead is there. And, you know, the schoolers are in the Big 12 as opposed to there. So I just think that, to me, I see UCLA having a better upside right now.
There are a number of teams who, you know, through different results in 2019, they've got a lot of room to grow based on the 2019. Obviously, UCLA and Arizona, two of them. So Oregon State looks way more improved and way more competitive last year. Cal, when Chase Garbers is healthy, certainly fits that as well. Washington State took a pretty big step back on defense after Alex Grinch left a couple years ago. Washington took a pretty big step back on offense with Jacob Eason last year, and they'll have a new quarterback, like you mentioned. Of all the teams, I suppose, in the Pac-12 that have obvious room to grow, who gives you the most confidence that they're going to approach their sort of growth ceiling based on what you've seen and what they look like right now?
I really think Cal is an easy choice for me on that. You mentioned Chase Garbers. When he was healthy, they were good. When he wasn't healthy, they were not good. In the bowl game, and our crew at Fox did the bowl game, all the guys who scored touchdowns for them were freshmen and sophomores. They're all back. In the secondary, it really helped them that they got Cam Bynum, who I think is arguably the best defensive back on the West Coast, or at least the best cornerback. I think Talanoa might be even better, but he's a leader and he's a really good corner. And I think that they have some really good pieces there of guys with experience at all three levels of the defense. I really think Justin Wilcox is a very underrated coach. I think they have a chance to be a real top 25 team. Christopher Brown's a big physical running back. They have some good young receivers. As I said, Garbers is very underrated. I like them a lot. I really do. I mean, it wouldn't shock me if they ended up winning the Pac-12, to be honest.
Wow. The other team I think that I think people are looking at in terms of showed flashes last year at times, especially with the quarterback, but wasn't always there. For sure wasn't always there, was ASU. ASU beats Oregon. They sort of have an up and down season. They look absolutely dreadful against Utah, but they have a high round talent in Brandon Ayuk leave for the NFL. So they're developing guys. They have interesting young talent. They've been recruiting interestingly. Are you as high on ASU as it seems many are who look at the depth, I guess, atop the conference?
I'm pretty high on them. I'm not maybe as high, but I really like Jaden Daniels. And remember, he played last year. One of the guys on their staff told me he was like 165 pounds. Now he's 180,
yeah, he was small.
80, 85. I think he will only get better. Now, look, you're right. They lost a terrific receiver in Ayuk. They lost a really good running back in Eno Benjamin. And I'm curious how they replace Eno on that front. I would pick them second in the South. I'm very interested to see how Marvin Lewis is as a defensive coordinator now and how that defense looks. But they're an interesting team. And I have to admit, I did not think Herm would have done this good of a job as the head coach there. And he has done a really good job. I mean, Herm Edwards, Mac Brown to me are, and then, like, Herm hasn't, you know, he's had some nice wins. His record hasn't been much different than Todd Graham's was, but I didn't think it would go this well. And I didn't, you know, like, you didn't ask me this, but I didn't think Mac would do as well as he has done so far at UNC.
Sure.
Now, he obviously has a terrific quarterback to build around, but I think those were ones that have been pleasant surprises. And I say pleasant surprises, not just because, you know, I think they're two personality types where Herm is an interesting guy. And I think he makes the Pac-12 a little more interesting. And so let's see what they do in year three. Cause it's, I think a lot of people now, as you alluded to, are in that like, hey, we have some expectations now. Let's see what happens.
Final question, just because you referenced being on the sidelines for seeing major programs, major schools, and big games, who in the Pac-12, when you are on the sideline or when you are at practice, and I know it's obviously been a different year this year, but when you look at the programs in the Pac-12 who can either compete nationally or look like they have a ceiling of competing nationally, how far away is the conference as a whole from, I don't know, the best five teams in the conference stacking up against the best five in the Big 12 or the ACC or the SEC or the Big 10? Is there a chasm, as some people like to say, or is it closer than you believe that the Warriors seem to think?
I think Oregon is that team off. I mean, you remember William Vlahos?
Yes.
Short offensive lineman at Alabama. He's a coach. And so I saw him, I think it was a Friday night game, Colorado against Oregon. It was at Autzen, and Vlahos was on the CU staff. And, you know, he was there with Mel Tucker, and he's, you know, like he's got good perspective and everything. And obviously he knew Mario Cristobal. And I remember I had talked to him on the, you know, pregame, and he eyeballed Oregon. He was like, that looks like an SEC team. And he's right. They do. And obviously it, you know, when you had Penei Sewell and a bunch of, you know, more experienced old linemen like they did, that added to it. But now you're going to have these huge linebacker dudes that have come into the program. Sewell's brother, you know, Mace Funa was there last year as a freshman. And you certainly add Justin Flo, who looks like a comic book hero kind of thing.
Yep.
That definitely does that. USC, I think, needs to continue to, you know, ramp up recruiting, but they have, you know, like I said, they have a receiver core that matches up pretty well with anybody. They have a bunch of guys like who do, you know, they have the thing with USC is a little bit of a misread is like, I remember going out there last year in the spring and seeing their linebacker group. And it's not just Naote Ote, who was obviously a huge recruit, but there was a couple mm-hmm. other guys who were like, I mean, a couple of those guys look like American Gladiator guys. Now they didn't play, like, you know, one or two of them were injured. And so, you know, sometimes with USC, it's like, you know about them in recruiting and then either they're hurt or something just isn't quite there. I think what's different with USC is they had for so long, they had some special running back there. Now it doesn't have to be Reggie Bush or even Lendale White, but right now you don't see, and Marquis Steph is talented and they have guys who are Stephen Carr have talent, but it's not like the one who's there, who's like the wow factor. Right. And
right.
So to me, those are the programs at this point that you could say, oh, if this breaks right or whatever, like, I think given all the stuff we talked about with the change with Oregon, new quarterback, new O-line, no more Javon Holland. I think that separates them from probably, you know, maybe they're a year away from being that team. You know, I don't know. But I think the way Mario has recruited there, it's an SEC vibe all the way around with Oregon. And I think there's some of that happening at USC at this point too.
All right, Bruce Feldman, SEC vibe all the way around, ties it really nicely back together to flip the script. Do check it out. About Ed Orgeron, about LSU, about George Costanza, I guess, in a roundabout way. Look it up, pick it up, digest it. You will like it, I promise you. Bruce, thank you so, so much for coming on The Solid Verbal.
Always a pleasure, Dan. Thank you for having me.
All right, Danny, that is Bruce Feldman.
Danny.
Bruce Feldman.
Yeah.
Fox Sports, The Athletic, author of the new book. Really interesting stuff from Bruce. If I don't say so myself, it always is. But, you know, the books that he's written in the past have been groundbreaking in a college football sense. Meat Market, right? Meat Market mm-hmm. is one of the best books I've ever read, period. It just so happens to be about college football. And, so it's always a pleasure when he drops something new, and I'm really excited to get a chance to read it. Haven't yet, but will soon.
Yeah, no, my copy is arriving shortly. My favorite thing that Bruce talked about in that interview, and this is the stuff that when you read pieces throughout the season, it's hard for guys to really extrapolate what's going on behind the scenes because everybody's interested in games. Everybody's interested in, oh man, why did LSU score so many points, blah, blah, blah. So when you have the time to write out books and look at your notes and listen to your tapes or whatever, when Bruce is talking about LSU's spring practice last year with Joe Burrow actively starting fights, with Joe Burrow saying, I don't want Max Protect. We need to get receivers on the field. I'll figure it out. With Joe Burrow absolutely torching a very, very good LSU first defense in spring practice and them, you know, having a sense like, oh, we might have like a team of killers here. And them having the sense behind the scenes that maybe they're not a national championship team, but all of a sudden this is a serious playoff contender. And knowing that from early on that something was just different with the makeup of that program last year. It's fascinating stuff to know that sort of lead time to the season. You're like, well, we're going to F up some teams, Ty. I like that. Those are the type of anecdotes I love.
Yeah.
Anecdotes.
Well, we'll make sure that we post the link so that you can check out Bruce's book and, you know, any and all Bruce Feldman works over at The Athletic as well. We're huge fans. He was one of our earliest guests on the show way back when. Has always been so gracious with his time, and he's a good friend of the show. So it's great to catch up with him once more.
Give me some elements of the Pac-12 season. I don't necessarily need specific matchups, but when you think about where the Pac-12 was last year, team by team, new faces, faces gone, faces returning, whatever. I just want some like straight out of the, you know, arrows out of the quiver, gun out of the holster, tie takes on what will make him turn it from an intriguing SEC game, an intriguing Big Ten game, to an intriguing Pac-12 game. What are you hoping to see from teams that will make you turn the dial?
Well, you know, the USC, the USC stuff is probably the low-hanging fruit here, but
okay.
The intrigue around Clay Helton and what his lifespan will be at USC is always interesting to me. If not
perfect
cliche,
schedule, by the way, for the Trojans,
it is.
Perfect.
It is.
Perfect. Yeah.
So I qualify that by saying interesting, if not cliche. And well, Keaton Slovis had an incredible year last year. Really burst onto the scene in an impressive way. And given the schedule, given the fact there is always good skill position talent at USC, if they could just get all cylinders firing at the same time, I would love to see what that team could do. They have not done that. Inconsistency has been a real problem for the Trojans over the last, I don't know, better part of the last decade, let's say. I would really like to see what they could do if they finally got everything on the same page. So that first and foremost, probably the low-hanging fruit. The Pac-12 North as a whole really intrigues me because I kind of don't know what to expect out of Washington and Washington State and even Stanford to some extent. Yeah. You know, I think we feel a degree of confidence with Oregon. They've had a bunch of opt-outs and there's, I know, a bunch of turnover there. But even beyond all that, the North really did for a long time feel like the stronger side of the conference, or at least the one with the fewest variables. And now with new coaches and with, I think, the step back we've seen from Stanford recently, I kind of don't know where it stands. Cal may have a clearer path to get up closer to the top of that side of the conference than we've seen before. They might not even play this weekend, but you know, there's a lot of intrigue for me in the North. And in the South, I would say just the, you know, Utah maybe is not the most exciting program in the world, but they did bring Jake Bentley over from South Carolina. And I'm curious to see how that plays out, if it looks any different with him.
A lot of new full-time faces.
Yeah, there's just a lot of like new things across the conference that I don't know, from a 30,000 foot view, catch my eye and keep me interested.
Yeah, I think all that's right. News came out that Jaden Delora, I want to make sure I pronounce that correctly, true freshman starting for Washington State, St. Louis High, the powerhouse high school in Honolulu, is starting for Washington State. I think he was either committed to Hawaii when Nick Rolovich was there or interested or something like that. And I think that connection really paid dividends if indeed Jaden Delora, who I think played really well, not huge, but played really well in high school, same area of, you know, Tua and Marcus Mariota went to St. Louis, I believe, and Dylan Gabriel, all those guys. So really rich history there on the islands. Yeah, there's so much unknown right now. I'd like to see Oregon State take a next step. I'd like to see ASU take a next step. I'd like to see Stanford correct whatever the hell went wrong. I know they have some promising guys on offense. The defense was rough at times last year. I want to see teams figure it out, because I want to go into the season thinking there are great games across the conference, even if it doesn't matter with the playoff or anything like that. But I want to care about ASU, USC more than I probably do right now, even though I'm intrigued. I want to care about Oregon, Washington. I want to know who's starting at quarterback for Washington. I want to care about the Territorial Cup, the right. U of A and ASU, stuff like that. I want Chip Kelly and UCLA to be, ooh, they just got scary. They are finally realizing the quote unquote Chip Kelly offense, whatever. I'm selfish and I want all of those things. So that to me is my sort of higher picture view, taller view of the conference. And I missed Oregon football, and it's very strange to say in a very strange season, but you watch other schools play, you're like, where are the Ducks? Where's my team? So excited to see a lot of those freshmen and the new Joe Moorhead offense for Oregon as well. That goes without saying.
Yeah, I mean, and you do another show on our trusty network here called Big Boy Bets with our friend Jeff Schwartz, another fellow Oregon alum.
Yeah.
What is the, I don't know, mood, given the fact that Oregon now is coming back? Like, it is such a weird year, and we've talked about this many times now. There's just sort of like, I don't know, glass ceiling almost, how excited you could get about a really oddly misshapen year due to the pandemic. How would you grade out your level of excitement for this iteration of the Oregon season versus normal circumstances?
I think people, Oregon fans, just want to watch the Ducks. I don't think it's a matter of like, oh man, can they get back to the Rose Bowl? Can they repeat? And like, they just want to watch new players, new coaches. I think there was a lot of frustration that Justin Herbert was kind of wasted with the old Oregon offense, and Joe Moorhead will give Oregon something more creative and new. So I think there's excitement about just watching the progression, the hopeful progression of what Oregon football can look like, especially with, I mean, opt-outs notwithstanding, with the reigning Outland Trophy winner in Penei Sewell and Javon Holland considered to be a top-flight draft prospect, the recruiting level, the talent level at Oregon has never been higher. So I think people are really excited to see, you know, how the gaps are filled in and the new faces, especially on defense, for sure. So I think two or three five-star guys are going to be in the rotation in that two deep on defense as true freshmen. So I think it's just a lot of excitement about unleashing so much talent, even behind Kayvon Thibodeau, who looks to be one of the best edge rushers in the country.
Really good. Yeah. No, I'm excited to see it too. It's as we've discussed here, this gradual build into a full season.
Yeah.
Whatever a full season is in this sense, it's we talked about it on Wednesday. You know, it's exciting that it's here. It's probably long overdue at this point for the Pac-12 being so everybody else started. And we just hope that situations at Cal and elsewhere can get cleared up and that we can get as much football out of this, 2020 season as possible.
Can I tie this all together to our guest, Bruce Feldman, in the UFO show?
Excuse me, the unbeatable Feldman orbit? Yes.
The unbeatable Feldman orbit. I'm going to focus on the name Bruce, because sometimes you come across people and people's lives, and this is all from Wikipedia. I did not do further research than a cursory scan of Wikipedia, and my jaw dropped.
Okay.
Bruce McCandless, McCandless. Okay.
Okay, I'm pulling this up. Go ahead. Continue.
Bruce McCandless completed the first untethered spacewalk using the manned maneuvering unit, that giant sort of rectangular boxy backpack looking thing.
The rocket.
Thrusters.
Yeah, the rocket backpack. Yes. Okay.
The rocket backpack. So untethered. He's not connected to the space shuttle. He did the first one, the first untethered MMU. Ty, it goes without saying, ballsy.
Yeah. A lot of like, pressure there. If you slip on the joystick, you know, that's an issue.
Float through space and hope for the best. So Bruce McCandless from Southern California goes to Stanford, gets his electrical engineering degree, gets an MBA, joins the Navy, is aboard multiple ships during the Cuban Missile Crisis, flying planes. I think that it was aircraft carriers. Yeah, it looks like he was aboard aircraft carriers during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Went to NASA, was the mission control capsule communicator on the Apollo 11 mission. Jesus. So he was communicating with Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong during launch and during the first moonwalk, okay? Then he gets involved in Skylab. He's like, he takes point on Skylab. He logged, eventually became, and this was like declassified, that he became a space shuttle pilot. He logged over 312 hours in space. The MMU time, 4 hours. 4 hours. He was a mission specialist on STS-41B, STS-31, whatever. He deployed satellites. He was all over the place. I actually did check. He worked for Lockheed Martin after he retired from NASA. He actually passed away 3 years ago. And across the board, people are like, yeah, this dude lived a life.
Yeah.
This dude lived a life. He graduated from his Navy graduating class or whatever, the Naval Academy, which he also received a Bachelor of Science from. He was in John McCain's graduating class. So some big names in that class, it wow. seems. And this was the after, the postscript, I guess, as it were. On September 30th, 2010, McCandless launched a lawsuit against British singer Dido for unauthorized use of a photo of his 1984 space flight Jesus. For the album art of her 2008 album Safe Trip Home, which showed McCandless, quote, free-flying about 320 feet away from the space shuttle Challenger.
My
They settled everything amicably, is what I'm reading here. But that is a life, Ty.
I have many thoughts on this. The first thing that comes to mind is that he is sort of like the space program's version of Forrest Gump, where he just shows up.
I was going to say the Dos Equis guy.
The Dos Equis guy, but Forrest Gump, I'm thinking of those scenes where he just sort of like wanders into the background of famous yes. news events and whatnot. But secondly, wow.
Well, this guy's foreground, to be clear.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Secondly, good hell, what a life.
Yeah.
What a life.
Bruce McCandless. Huh. Sometimes you just stumble upon these things. You're like, holy hell, this guy was all over from all Long right. Beach, Southern California guy.
Well, look, fun show. Weird way to end it, but always informative on the UFO yeah. show. We would encourage everybody to subscribe if they haven't already. Do check out the Patreon at verballers.com as well as our social media accounts, which you could find pretty much everywhere. Just look for The Solid Verbal. We've also got a YouTube channel at youtube.com/the Solid Verbal. Dan, we will be talking to folks on the Patreon and our Discord channel. We would urge everybody, if you're not there and you still want to be part of the activity, 408-VERBAL-1 is the reverb line. It's 408-837-2251. That's how you can get in touch with us and give us your thoughts. Stream of consciousness throughout the course of a college football game day on Saturday.
Yeah.
We'll pick our favorites and put them together on Sunday.
I can't wait, Ty. I cannot wait.
For that guy over there, my good friend, Dan Rubenstein, for myself, Ty Hildebrandt, we will talk to y'all in a few days. Have a good weekend. Stay solid.
Peace.